Well, hello, everyone. Happy Monday. I hope everyone's doing well today. I'm Pam Stack, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. If you're listening to us live right now, please click the follow button. So my boss knows I'm doing my job. I promise I won't send you any email. You can find us all over social media. Don't hesitate to contact us. We're glad to hear from you. You can find me at Twitter at Pam Stack Host or at Authors on the Air. Tonight, one of my most favorite people in the entire world is back again with me, Professor David Morrell. As you well know by now, unless you've lived in a foreign country where there is no social media, internet, books, or anything, is the creator of Rambo. It's interesting because just yesterday, one of the television networks was doing a 5 Rambo series right in a row. And it reminded me again how blessed I am to know David Morrell. He's a wonderful gentleman. But we had an interesting discussion online about Frank Sinatra. And unbeknownst to me, David Morrell wrote a book about Frank Sinatra and why he believes he is probably the best musician of his time. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the Authors on the Air studio, Professor David Morrell. Hi, David. How are you this evening?
Hey, hi. And we should, before we started, you and I mentioned about how this thing about, I was in fact a professor at the University of Iowa for many years. I taught literature. But that was a while ago, and it makes me smile that my friends still call me professor.
Well, you know, as we were talking, I was introduced to you that way many years ago when we were at Thriller Fest, and I have to thank John Land for that. But it's kind of stuck, and so every time I have an opportunity and you honor me with an interview, I just feel like it's you, after all, have your PhD in literature, and you were a professor, and it just seems to—I mean, I could call you Dr. Morrell, but it seems that I should.
And then
really
I operate
say,
on your appendix.
There you go, and so that's why I say professor. How are you, David? Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you. You're in Florida, I believe.
I am.
And as a consequence, you have not accumulated the snow that's elsewhere.
Nope.
I'm in New Mexico in Santa Fe. We had 4 storms 2 weeks ago. We had 4 storms in a row, but the snow is gone now. We're in the mountains. A lot of people think we're like Phoenix, but Santa Fe's in the mountains. It's a ski area, and we have about 100 inches now up on the mountain, and we're happy to get it because of the reservoirs in the city.
Sure.
I was. Just before we came on, I was thinking about all the folks that experienced that amazing weather in the Northeast.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like when I look at pictures of snow on cactus, it's incongruous to me. I can't wrap my brain around that. It's so odd looking. And you have to remember that I was living in Miami in 1974 when it snowed in Miami. Now, it didn't snow hard or anything, you know, but the flakes did touch the windshield of my car when I was driving. And I thought, and I remember the day exactly, I was driving to work and I was going right by Miami International Airport. I really thought this was it. We didn't use the word apocalypse back then, but I have to tell you, I thought the day of reckoning is on nigh. So I feel the same way when I look out where you live and there's snow on cactus. It's just as mind-boggling to me. I can't wrap my head around that.
We're what we call high desert. I'm at 7,000 feet above sea level. That's higher than Denver. And I'm surrounded by what they call pinon trees, a form of pine, and juniper. So I don't see a lot of cactus. It's a different way of people think, and I know when I first came out here, I thought, oh, I'm going to Phoenix, but that was not the case. Lots of trees. So Frank Sinatra, huh? How could it be that we are talking about Frank Sinatra?
Well, it was so funny because, you know, I had received a message from one of the publishing houses about a man who teaches, coincidentally, at Brooklyn College, I think it was, who teaches literature, and he wrote a very interesting book about Frank Sinatra. And because so much had been written on him, and what he wanted to do was something a little bit different, so he wrote this book in a style of 100 notes about Sinatra, things that were common knowledge and things that weren't. So it's a very interesting compilation of sometimes just one sentence or very, very short memo style notes about Frank Sinatra's life. And you mentioned on that post that you had also written a book about Frank Sinatra.
Well, I was very fascinated that you were, we might as well give due credit. What's the name of the book?
His book was Frank Sinatra, Life and Times. It's out of my head because I'm looking at yours right now, and that's why I don't have it in my mind. But
maybe as we get through, we can, go back to it. What happened is I saw you were talking about Sinatra, and not everybody knows that I've written an awful lot. I mean, people think of me as a novelist and Rambo creator and, a lot of other things, Brotherhood of the Rose and Murder of the Fine Art and what have you. Victorian literature these days, Victorian thrillers. But I initially, when I was a teenager, I wanted to be in the music business. And now, in itself, this is not a great flash because I don't know about so much these days, but there's a certain generation where everybody wanted to be a singer, songwriter, what have you. And what made the difference for me, I was very young. I was only like 16. But I had this idea that if you were going to pursue music, maybe it would be a good idea to learn something about it. And which was more than the 3 or 4 chords that most popular songs of the era had. And so I found a guy who was a classical composer who'd received it. I was raised in Canada and near Toronto, and this fellow had, his name was Wilfred Kunz, K-U-N-Z, and he had a degree in music, advanced degree from the University of Toronto, and was a composer and a conductor, and he was taking students in where I lived in this twin city called Kitchener-Waterloo. So I dutifully trundled down, and I learned how to play the piano, and I learned theory, musical theory, and harmony, and counterpoint, and orchestration, and just a ton of stuff. And I did all this before I was 18. Then I had what could amount to a nervous breakdown. I was working so hard on the music. I was just so determined. I wanted to be Frank Sinatra's arranger. Nelson Riddle just fascinated me, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool to be Nelson Riddle? To shorten the story, I became so obsessed with music for those 2 years that it was as if a black cloud descended over me completely negated my interest in music. I had been going at it for so long that, and a young person, and I, social activities and everything I'd just thrown aside, and it was like something switched off. And so I felt really strong about Frank Sinatra because in 1965, this is many years later, he released an album called September of My Years, which was in honor of his 50th birthday, which itself was a hell of a thing to do because popular singers don't advertise they're getting older. And that album and the way he handled those songs rekindled my interest in music. So I have a really, really sentimental attachment to Sinatra.
It's interesting. Now, let me add, maybe you know, because Mr. Lehman, when he was here, did not know. Did Nelson Riddle go on to be the bandmaster for Jackie Gleason's show?
No.
It wasn't.
No.
Know he was somebody. I know he was somebody's, and I can't remember who it was. I know Nelson
Riddle worked a lot with Rosemary Clooney. He did a lot of television stuff. He worked with Clooney particularly.
Yes.
And, you know, he was doing, I mean, Riddle's a strange man. He was so driven to succeed, and he had a large family. And all he did was work, and he didn't get paid that much. In my book about Sinatra is called Frank Sinatra, the Artist and His Music, and it's only about the music. It's only about Sinatra as a singer, and with a lot of Nelson Riddle thrown in. And I maintain that the finest arranged American song, I'm saying this all backward, but Frank Sinatra's I've Got You Under My Skin, arranged by Nelson Riddle, is the finest arranged song there ever was. And for that arrangement, which the story behind it is amazing, Frank had recorded an album called Songs for Swingin' Lovers, and there were, let's say, 13 tracks on it. And the record company wanted to do a special promotion and said, we want two more recordings, and we need them by tomorrow night.
Wow.
And Frank had pissed off, called Riddle at like 10 o'clock at night and said, I need two more arrangements by this time tomorrow night. And one of them's going to be I've Got You Under My Skin, and I want you to give it lots of, this is Frank talking, this is the way he spoke, I want you to give it lots of crescendo. Now, what Riddle understood that to mean was that the song would start in a more or less calm fashion and then build and build and build and build, which is what the arrangement does. So Riddle phoned a friend of his who he said, I don't know what the hell to do. And this guy was a trombonist. And he said, you know, and he started mentioning songs that had built on a crescendo. And so anyway, Riddle wrote all day long, and they were actually, his wife was driving him to the recording session at like 8 o'clock at night, and Riddle was in the back seat still writing the chart. And
wow.
They get to the studio, Sinatra's waiting impatiently, and I, as I said, pissed off, and Frank was perpetually pissed off because he, you know, alcohol, and he didn't get along. And so the copyists were ready to do all the parts and hand them out, and it was like a free-for-all to record the darn thing. And at one point, Riddle had a bass trombonist doing a solo, and the guy couldn't lift the heavy instrument for the microphone. And Sinatra himself ran over and got a crate so the guy could stand on it to get it up to the microphone.
God.
And if my memory were sufficient, if I had my notes, I'd be able to tell you who that trombonist was. He was very famous. And when they were all done, and this hardly ever happens, the musicians applauded.
Wow.
Anyway, now here's the story. Riddle works like hell to do the arrangement, you know, and it's under pressure, and Frank was so unforgiving. Riddle got $100 for the arrangement. Frank used that arrangement in almost every concert for the rest of his life. And Riddle figured he got, if you amortize the thing, that he got about 5 cents.
For every time.
Per performance. So.
That's horrible. Anyway. I just wikied Nelson Riddle while we were talking. Here is really an interesting thing about Nelson Riddle. I mean, I knew he worked with Linda Ronstadt when she was doing some stuff. But he created the music for the Adam West television show Batman. He also wrote the theme for Emergency. He was a musical director for Julie Andrews, and that's who I couldn't remember. That's why I couldn't remember, because I know she would mention him occasionally, and that's why I couldn't remember his name.
Oh, everybody loved working with him.
Yeah. Now,
but As you started to talk about his composing credits,
yes,
the big one, and interestingly, this somehow connects with my career. Riddle wrote the music for the television series Route 66.
Right.
And
yes.
That's not the Hey, Get Your Kicks on Route 66 song, which really
right.
had nothing to do with it. Every week he wrote an original score for this series, which was about two young men in a Corvette convertible who drove across the United States. And the promo used to say, in search of America and in search of themselves. And interestingly, if not for Route 66 and the wonderful scripts by Sterling Siliphant, I never would have been tempted to switch from being a musician to becoming a writer. So Riddle, it's funny, we started talking about Frank and now we're talking about Nelson Riddle. This all sort of combines for, you know, a progress, let's call it, a theme, you know, at least in my life.
It's interesting to me, as an interviewer, you and I've talked about this before, but you're so creative and you have so many different interests. It's not surprising to me that you also had a great interest in music. Now, we discussed this before you came on the show, and I said to you, I wanted to play piano so bad, so I took organ and piano lessons. I can play, believe it or not, I used to be able to play an accordion. I can play a guitar. I can play a harpsichord. But none of that was because I had any God-given talent. I wasn't born with it. I could technically play those instruments
and
play them the right way. But there's something inherently different when you listen to someone who is truly born with the talent for playing an instrument versus someone who has to learn to play an instrument. Like I say, technically everything I did was correct. It's just not the same. And then, of course, at least in my opinion, I think that there are people who just are born to play an instrument, and it wasn't me.
Well, it's like, I'm in awe. I can play the piano in a way. I'm kind of an idiot savant.
Right.
In my prime, because I know so much about musical theory, and I can transpose amazingly fast, that for a time, dance bands, they heard about this idiot gift I had, which I'm going to explain. they would, if their pianist got ill, and these are not rock and roll bands, these are dance bands. These were places, you know, for weddings and things. And they would call me because they knew I could come in and read the charts. I couldn't do solos, but I could read the chord symbols. And I could read them up to three flats and three sharps so that it didn't matter and I didn't need to rehearse. I could do a rhythm piano based upon reading, you know, what does F7th mean, or,
right.
you know, what is G9th or what have you.
Right.
And so I made a pretty good amount of money when I was a kid. They'd say, hey, can you be here at 8 o'clock? Sure. And I didn't need the rehearsal. And I dare say you could have done the same thing.
Well, for me, it was just more fun. I really, really enjoyed doing it. And at the time, you know, garage rock and roll bands were starting up, and that I played the keyboards was always very interesting. So they always would say, oh, you have to teach us how to do keyboards, because that was like an added zing if you had a garage band with a keyboard player. So the one thing I could do that is very unusual, I have always wished that I had a voice to sing. I would almost trade in just about anything to be able to carry a note. I'm so totally tone deaf. With singing, it's horrible. It's an embarrassment. When I sing to my cats, they cover their ears and run away. But it's so bad. But
I'm laughing.
Here's the funny thing. You can clink a spoon against a glass, and I can tell you exactly what note it is and where on the scale it is. I can hear a note perfectly. So a lot of very popular singers, particularly vocalists, who people just love, and I say, yeah, but they sing about a quarter note off key.
They're flat. And that's right.
Yeah, they don't hear it, and I hear it. It makes me absolutely crazy. But
do you hear car engines this way?
I do. I hear every
The mailman now, like, in my neighborhood has a engine that's in B flat, and I can always hear him coming down the street apart from all the other cars that go by.
I can actually listen to a full orchestra, or even when I went to the opera all the time. I used to go to opening night at the opera in Miami. Or if I listen to a big band, I can separate out every single instrument.
This is weird. I don't know how weird it is. Part of the training for me to want to be an arranger. So you know the whole way note paper looks for arranging. You know, it's in a ladder, as
right.
it were.
Your manager,
and
right.
What I learned from this. I think it's one way that music carried over into writing, is that I was able to differentiate as you can, the different levels of the instruments.
Yeah.
So that what I'm seeing is I'm literally seeing the sounds. That you know the violins above whatever down to you know the bass line, as if I'm reading the chart, and I think this helped me as a writer to understand you know undertone and you know things along that to see depths and levels that I might not otherwise note.
Interesting. It's fascinating to me. So. Have you always followed Sinatra since you decided that he had written this absolutely fantastic, or sang this absolutely fantastic song? You know, I have friends, author Will Graham, who's a dear friend of mine, is a Sinatra fanatic. He saw him twice in Vegas, and I'm so jealous of that. He saw Dean Martin, you know. I like all that old music because my keyboard teacher was an older man, and so I learned music from my parents. I learned a lot of the old music that were in my parents' generation. You can imagine I was a hit whenever they had parties. Play the keyboards, Pam, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
It was embarrassing, but I played regardless. But I guess from that, David, it comes my love of all kinds of music. Do you like that particular style of music only? Sinatra's music, or do your taste for music run across the board?
Well, it runs across. I mean, there are standards, and one of the things that Sinatra teaches people is, you know, the way it ought to be done. And one of the reasons I wrote this ebook, Frank Sinatra, the Artist and His Music, was because I felt that there were a lot of people who liked popular music but didn't know the good stuff from the bad stuff, and didn't know proper technique from non-proper technique. And, you know, my goal in writing the book was to demonstrate to people that you could, in fact, discuss singing in a way that you could agree that this person is better, and not in personal taste, but just better demonstrably than somebody else. And so... with Sinatra, what we have is this strange, perhaps unreplicable combination of abilities. One of which was his drive, which we, you know, alluded to with you and I, you know, pursuing music doggedly, but we didn't have, you know, that grace, whatever it is. And Frank was born with an instrument in his throat that was preternatural, right? I mean, it's not something that anybody, you know, maybe once in 100 years would have. So he had the instrument. But then we add to this, you know, because, you know, people often ask me about writing, what are the keys, what, you know. And one is, of course, talent. You have to be able to tell a story. And another is discipline, and to, you know, and determination, and another is luck. And what people, the key to Frank Sinatra granting his preternatural ability, which if we have time we can get deeper into, is that he was scarred on his face from birth.
I was just going to ask you about that because that was in your book, and I find that fascinating. It is nothing you ever read about. You just don't read about things like that.
And people ignore it. He did not have surgery for it. Those scars, if you're willing to look and forget it, Frank Sinatra, they are manifest. There is a major scar down the left side of his cheek, just over from his lip. There are major scars on the left side of his neck, and there is a deformed ear on the left side of his head. All of which were the consequences of a not very successful home delivery. And he nearly died being delivered. And in fact, the story goes that they said he was dead and they put him in a sink. And if it hadn't been for his grandmother saying, I'm going to give it a shot and pouring cold water over him, that he would have died then and there. But he was deformed, and the street kids when he grew up called him Scarface, and he, to disguise this, used a ton of pancake makeup to when he was in his 60s and his 70s. And people listening to this will say, oh no, that can't be true. Get a close up photograph of Frank Sinatra and look, the scar down the side of his face, the scar on his neck, the scar on his ear. And in Frank told most of his directors in movies, shoot me from my right side. That wasn't always the case, but it happened. So here's what we got. We got a guy with an unusual voice. We've got a guy who was scarred and who was belittled, who was abused by his mother. She used to beat him. And then we have Bing Crosby was the guy in the 1930s.
Right.
Because of the invention of the microphone and the radio, Crosby was the first guy who took advantage of this intimate way of communicating to a large group. And Frank saw him in New Jersey live in concert, and Frank was there with his girlfriend who became his first wife.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank walked out of there saying, I'm going to be Bing Crosby. And that was, from there on, Sinatra, from that moment, is doggedly pursuing, as it were, he's overcoming the fact that he's Italian, and Crosby was Irish at a time previously in the 20s when the Irish were looked down on, and now the Italians were looked down on. So Sinatra sort of saw that parallel, and he says, I'm gonna be Bing Crosby, and off he goes, and it takes him quite a while, but he's so determined and so in his mind, so hurt, that he's determined to triumph over this and show people that he's somebody. So it's, you know, it's an interesting combination of forces.
Yeah.
And then just to add, he was so smart, and he had the ability to act, to communicate emotion. And one of the things people don't know about him is that if he took a song, particularly an emotional song, what he would do is get a notepad and a pen or a pencil, and he would write the lyrics out. And then he'd throw that page away, and he'd write the lyrics again. And he'd throw that page away, and he'd write the lyrics again. And with each writing, he would internalize the lyric until he convinced himself that it was the story of his life.
Interesting that you say that, because the last gentleman that was here said the exact same thing. He was a very emotional singer, and that way that he sang really got to people. Really got to them a lot. Now, you write in your book also that He was a self-described manic depressive. But
yes.
What he did was he learned a new way to breathe that he introduced singers. Tell me about that.
Well, this is the key. See, we're building in stages. A guy with an unusual voice, a guy with the drive, a guy with the intelligence, a guy with the ability to communicate emotions and know how to convey it. So, but now comes the extra step. Singing, one of the things that Crosby did was Crosby is always distant from his songs.
Yes.
And Crosby tends to sing a long line, by which I mean he might go 4 bars or even 8 bars before he breathes.
Yes.
But Sinatra was a part of the Tommy Dorsey band, and he was on the road, you know, for a year and a half, whatever it was, maybe longer. And apart from when he was singing, all he had to do was sit and watch Tommy Dorsey play the trombone. And what began to this very, very smart Sinatra, he's so smart, and he's thinking, wait a minute, there's something weird going on here. Dorsey doesn't breathe. That it would appear that Dorsey, having put the instrument to his mouth, could play the whole damn song and never once take a breath. And what Frank realized that Dorsey was doing was so not like what anybody else was doing in music at that time, where, you know, the long line, the 4 bars or the 8 bars, what Dorsey was doing was sipping oxygen, as it were, between phrases. So Dorsey might play 4 notes and pause, and that's where he breathed. And then he'd take another four notes or maybe another 8 notes, and then he'd pause and breathe. And the phrasing felt very natural. It felt like he was pausing for emotion and for sense, but he was also using it to take short breaths rather than long breaths. And Sinatra, watching this, thought, I get it. So I could break up, he thinks. I can take a lyric. And we'll just use "I Get Along Without You Very Well," very famous, you know, beginning of "Course I Do," right? Now, the standard way that a singer of the time would do it is, "I get along without you very well, of course I do." And what Sinatra would do is, "I get along, breathe, without you, breathe very well." And so he could take, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of breaths within a lyric, allowing himself to pause and to communicate an emotional density in this phrase, and no one had ever done that before.
And
that
that
was
emotional,
the secret to Frank Sinatra. Yeah.
That was where the emotion came in. Did he teach others to do this, or did they catch on? Was this something he would say to his contemporaries and other vocalists of the time?
He wrote, it's a funny thing, you know, the Sinatra family wants to make it seem that Frank was self-taught and, you know, just a natural genius.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, too.
But the
truth
is,
he was taught by an opera singer, wasn't he?
He was taught by an opera singer, that's right.
I love
that. The story is, and again, you know, the mythology here is so interesting. Sinatra's, it's the late 30s, and he's young. He's going to Tin Pan Alley, the Brill Building and what have you in New York. And there were two guys there. There were three, really, but two are important for the music. One was Sammy Kahn, a songwriter, and the other guy was a guy named Chester Babcock. What a name. And Chester hated his name so much he changed it to Jimmy Van Heusen. And it shows you it was after the shirt factory. That's how, you know, underclass these guys were, that they thought the name of a shirt factory was class. But Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen knew music, both as composers, and they knew the good stuff from the bad stuff. And here we are in the 1930s in Broadway, and they gave Sinatra an education. They said, here, Frank, this is a good song, this is a bad song, and this is why. And Frank became to understand that the really good stuff came out of Broadway, which is what he tended to stick with for the Great American Songbook. And what these two guys at that time, Frank Sinatra's New Jersey accent was as thick as can be. And what these guys said was, Frank, you got to get rid of that accent. And they found an opera singer, a metropolitan tenor. Now, I don't want to, you know, the rumor is the guy had been let go because he liked to drink. I emphasize the rumor because for all I know, this guy's ancestors are still around. But that's the story. And Frank went to him, and the guy gave him exercises, the equivalent of many brave hearts are asleep in the deep, that kind of thing. And we know about all this because in 1942, Tommy Dorsey had a musical publication company, and he published something called Tips for Popular Singers by Frank Sinatra in collaboration with his vocal coach. And again, if I thought I'd have my notes with me to give you the name of the teacher, the Metropolitan Tenor. So we know the exercises that Sinatra used and that the Met coach gave to him. And that was the extra finishing touch. Actually, there was one more, but the second last finishing touch was that Sinatra learned how to speak precisely when he was singing, how to enunciate. This wasn't always the case. If you listen to interviews with him, he lapses back into the New Jersey accent. But for Sinatra, when he was singing, using the Met tenor as his model, if you listen to that, like the story was that in the 40s, when a lot of immigrants came over, they were playing Frank Sinatra records to learn how to pronunciate. And part of the fun of listening to Sinatra, if you know the song really well, is to listen to him hit his T's and to close off his S's in the way he sings. I mean, it's just a masterpiece. And what he'll do if he has, we'll just use I've got you under my skin. That's a mouthful.
Sure.
And every once in a while, you'll find a later version of it where he says, "I've got to get G-O-T-C-H-U." But in his prime, it's so crisp. I've got you under my skin, and somehow he's able to sing while being that precise. And often he'll use these separation of words to get that extra sip of breath. So we have, and Sinatra was the first popular singer to go around to concert halls. This is back in the 40s when he was singing with Dorsey, and a little bit later he'd go around to the equivalent of Carnegie Hall and do with a classical symphony behind him, sing popular songs as if they were as serious as any other kind of music, and that's because he had this wonderful diction. And then I'll just quickly say one more thing about this. Sinatra's on the biggest thing, if you want to put it all up into a pyramid, was his understanding that the microphone in the modern era was the singer's instrument. And so he would move, if you watch him in concert, there are many, many, many videos, if you watch him in concert, he'll move the microphone in and out toward or away from his mouth the way he would a trombone, as it were, on the slide. Or, you know, if he wants to take a breath, he will turn his face slightly to the right or the left of the microphone. So you never, it is very unusual. I would say in, you know, how many hundreds and thousands of Frank Sinatra recordings, you might catch him breathing on three or four. But you'll never, and those weren't edited out like they are now. Honest, true breath control, or hiding it by turning his head. And, you know, I watch modern singers on television or, you know, on Saturday Night Live where they have the latest act on, and it is appalling to see these amateurs who don't know how to use microphones, they don't know how to speak, they don't know how to breathe, and they don't know how to communicate the lyrics. I mean, it's, you know, once you crack the Frank Sinatra code, so to speak, and you know, and realize what a genius this guy was putting these things together in ways that no one before him had done. It's pretty revealing.
When he said that he wanted to be Bing Crosby, he really exceeded his own desire because of what he did. Did he not?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And we have to remember he appeared in two movies with Bing. One was High Society, where he was with Grace Kelly. And then later he was in Robin and the Seven Hoods with Bing. By then Bing was all messed up, but you know, by messed up, I mean he wasn't in his prime. You know, he was just sort of you know, there. But the once you know the secret about Frank Sinatra wanting to be Bing Crosby, then the laugh gets bigger, so to speak, when Frank courting the Kennedys and having helped John F. Kennedy to become president, and, you know, whatever all the mob stuff that might have been involved there, but he helps Kennedy become president, and then all of a sudden the Kennedys say, wait a minute, you know, we think Frank is mobbed up. We don't want to hang around with him anymore. It was good to get his help, but, you know, maybe not anymore. But meanwhile, Frank has put in a helipad for the president on his Palm Springs property, and he's converted one of the cottages on his property for Kennedy. And Peter Lawford phones him and says, you know, Frank, I hate to tell you this, but the president isn't coming to your place. And Frank goes crazy, and then he says, well, where the hell is he going? And Lawford says, over to Bing Crosby's place.
I never heard
Sinatra,
that.
Sinatra went nuts. It's so painful that, you know, yeah, it's a shame to laugh about it, but once you know his lifelong envious, this is too funny.
That's funny. Let me just take a break here. I want to remind everyone this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I am speaking with the wonderful David Morrell. Normally when Professor Morrell is here, we talk about books and writing and craft and research. We talk about daydreams and creativity and all, and it's a wonderful conversation. But this time we're talking about Professor Morrell's love of music and why he believes Frank Sinatra was one of a kind. And certainly, by everything you've said, he truly was. If you'd like to call in and talk to David Morrell, please do. The number is 347-633-9609. That's 347-633-9609. The phone lines are open. First caller gets a book from me, Frank Sinatra, The Artist and His Music by David Morrell. So give us a call. David, I have, it's kind of a, this is peripherally around Sinatra. He was a very, very smart man. He saw his colleagues and entertainers around him being taken advantage of and having their names used in advertising and, you know, maybe on T-shirts for something really obnoxious getting compensated for it. He was one of the first entertainers who went about copywriting his image and everything he had to do. And his family, including his first wife, to this day remains very, very true to protecting his image. What did you learn about that when you were researching this book?
Not a lot. I tried to get in touch with him. I wanted somebody there, you know, to look at the book that I was writing, you know, with the understanding that it was about the music. Inevitably I had to talk about the mob because Frank sang in nightclubs. So, you know, I mean, it's there. You can't get away from the mobs and sing in nightclub or in Vegas in those days. So I, you know, but apart from that, I thought I was pretty, pretty true to. So, you know, there are Sinatra websites run by the family, but I couldn't get through. By contrast, Nelson Riddle's website it was very open, and one of his daughters, Rosemary, was very kind to me and read, because I have this second e-book, it's a shorter book called Nelson Riddle, The Man Behind the Music, and Rosemary, Sarah is her name, she was very open, she read the material, and she told me, you know, where biographically I was maybe a little off and that I should correct this or that, and, you know, she was very welcoming, so, but, you know, it's not as if I needed the Sinatra family to, because there's, you know, they've given so many public comments already that
right.
It was more helpful for Rosemary, Sarah, Nelson Riddle's daughter, you know, to one of his daughters to help me.
What a shame that Nelson Riddle died so young. He was 64, I believe.
Well,
he
worked, God bless him, he worked himself to death. I mean,
well,
you know,
yes.
He had, as I said, all these children, and he was writing chart after chart, and he was writing, you know, for 4 years he wrote the music for Naked City. For one of those years at least, I'm sorry, for Route 66, for one of those
right.
years at least he wrote the music for Naked City. And then he was doing all this other stuff, and a lot of, he was under a contract to Capitol Records at a time when Frank started Reprise. And what isn't known is that a lot of the orchestrations that Frank recorded in the early Reprise days were Nelson Riddle arrangements, but they couldn't give Nelson the credit. And you know, on and on. And so you mentioned Linda Ronstadt.
Mm-hmm.
And Nelson was able to use a lot of the variations on the Sinatra charts that he'd written and to, you know, work with Linda. And what amazed him was how much recording had changed, because Linda and those how did she did at least two Nelson Riddle albums,
right.
And they were big money makers, and for the first time Nelson was terribly envious of Henry Mancini, because they'd both been trained by the same person out in L.A., a music theorist, but Mancini was able to get the rights somehow to get his name more public, partly because Blake Edwards was generous to him, the director, but you know, there's Nelson, you know, sort of slaving away, and for the first time with the Linda Ronstadt albums, he got a percentage of sales, so he earned a significant amount of money. But what he said was that it astonished him. You know, they it took them a year to make one of those albums, you know, that
mm-hmm.
they'd have to patch stuff together and, you know, do all that mixing that modern arrangers, you know, have to, engineers have to do. And you know, he privately said that, my God, you know, with Frank, we were putting down four charts a night. And we didn't need a re-record. We didn't need a splice. They were perfect. And they were live, and Frank was digging it with, and he had an audience there with him, part as well as the band. And Frank could do four a night, so he could do an album in three nights. And with
Amazing.
Linda, it took 6 months to a year.
Well, and Lush Life, which was the album that was so successful, and I think she did Pirates too, Pirates of Penzance with me. But it was just a remarkable album. It was so groundbreaking. I'm always interested in what has happened to a lot of the singers from that era. And I'm particularly fascinated because, you know, a lot of them retired and are very happy and they're doing well and so on. We've lost so many great singers. But one who stays in my mind is Tony Bennett, who still sings. He still sings, and his voice maybe is not what it used to be, but when he sings with a lot of very current vocalists, and he still is a showman. He's figured out how to make it work for himself.
It's interesting you mention him, because mm-hmm. Tony Bennett came here to Santa Fe 2 years ago, and mm-hmm. I think he was 86 then. And, of course, one gets suspicious about a vocalist at 7,000 feet, mm-hmm. at 86 years of age. But he was singing. Santa Fe has a world-class opera, so he went to the opera yes. house to perform, and the place was packed, and it is, you know, there are certain moments in you know, when we see performers. I once saw Mel Torme and George Shearing together. Mm-hmm. Oh, what a night. And Tony Bennett came out, and he did an hour and a half. And I mean, you could have fooled me. He was 86 years old. And again, it's about the phrasing. It's about yes. the breath control. And Tony, you know, and Frank talked a lot about music. And Frank, I'm a little hazy on this part. I'm not a Tony Bennett expert, but it's my understanding that Frank was instrumental in helping Tony. There's a side story here. Tony Bennett has a performer's school that he funded and that he supports. It's for, you know, young people to, you know, learn how to do music and sing and perform. And, it, you know, it's very successful. It's and it costs a lot of money. And Tony did not call it the Tony Bennett School of Performing or whatever it is. It's the Frank Sinatra School of Performing, even though it's Tony's school.
Interesting.
So there's some sort of thing was going on there way back in which, you know, the people were learning from one another. And Tony, you know, has acknowledged a tremendous debt there. But I got to tell you, you know, the whole thing, you know, the phrasing, the emotion. One of the things that Tony Bennett, at 86 years old, you can't sing love songs and, you know, with any passion and be believable. But what he does is, you know, I get a kick out of you. He's not thinking about a woman. He's speaking to the audience.
Yes.
You know, so it's a love affair with the audience.
When he leaves his heart in San Francisco, you feel it. It's interesting me because I think when he was about 80 years old, he did he released an album that I think was called Duets. I'm not sure, but I remember that he sang with people like Elvis Costello and Elton John and Sting and Bono, and he worked with Lady Gaga later on an album.
A brilliant collaboration.
Yeah, truly. And with Queen Latifah. So he was really, really amazing. And I think he is still an amazing man.
Oh, there's no question.
Yeah, I think he contributes so much to the musical landscape.
But, you know, now here's an example. We were talking about Lady Gaga. I was very mm-hmm. suspicious of Lady Gaga. I'd seen her performing, you know, doing what it was she was doing, you know, for her main act. And I thought, oh, dear, now she's working with Tony Bennett, and, you know, how is she going to keep up? And, you know, but she's a very fast learner, and she picked up quickly.
Classically trained opera singer.
Yes. Exactly.
And she's
so
also
she knows
a classical pianist as well. Did you hear her do a tribute to Julie Andrews?
I never did. No, I didn't know. I didn't know she could play the piano, but I can tell you, you know, using Frank Sinatra as our standard, she's the real deal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She has an incredible voice. She's classically trained opera singer. She is a soprano, and she also is a classically trained pianist. I think it was for the Grammys last year, maybe. Everybody was talking about it. She sang The Sound of Music, The Hills Are Alive, that made Julie Andrews famous from that movie.
I'd say I saw that. It was astonishing.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I knew that she had been classically trained. I don't like her contemporary music, but and I had heard her sing on other YouTube videos and all that, but to see her actually sing that, now I'm on a TV, so I watch it on my laptop, but to see her singing, I was blown over by, she has such a vocal range. I was really impressed with her. And a couple other things, since we're talking about the odd mixtures of people. People know that I love music, and they know that I was in love with Luciano Pavarotti. I had the distinct pleasure of one of the things on my bucket list was seeing him in concert. And one year, the three tenors came to Miami for a charity event. The tickets were $1,000 a piece, and I want to tell you, I bought two tickets, and I sat right in the front row in front of Pavarotti. And when he, oh my God, it was amazing. But yeah. Now, so I get videos sent to my Facebook page. They have a video of him singing James Brown, the Godfather of Soul.
Sure.
Pavarotti sang in Italian, and James Brown sang It's a Man's World. The amazingness, it was just, I had goosebumps, David. I also just saw a video with him with Bryan Adams, who, you know, back in the summer of 69, he was did the music for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, that dear Alan Rickman was in, the beloved Alan Rickman, he just died. So to see these cross are singing together to me is fascinating.
Well, they know their business, you know. So the key, I think, you know, if we wanted to cut through, because people don't necessarily always pay attention to breath control or pronunciation,
yes.
But
yes.
I feel as if the golden rule should be, are they making sense of the lyric? And there are any number of singers, and Saturday Night Live is just every week I watch, hopefully, and every week, just about every week I'm disappointed, where the singer is absolutely so having difficulty controlling the melody that the sense of the lyric is just going away somewhere.
Wow.
You know, there should be that personal sense of the emotion of them speaking to us. It occurs to me another singer who's long, long gone is Bobby Darin could do this. He didn't have a great voice, but Bobby Darin could communicate a song and hold somebody's attention, you know, in a concert for 90 minutes without our wondering, you know, why are you up there? So I put Darin also in this category. And he understood about breath control, too.
I think that for me, since opera has always been one of my first loves, I'm spoiled a lot because of listening to some of the best sopranos and tenors, and of course the other operatic singers. But I think if you've never seen Frank Sinatra sing, and you wanted to learn how people enunciate words and how a singer can communicate emotion, you get all that with very fine opera. In my opinion, you do.
Yeah, I would agree. The problem, of course, is that at least people in the United States, it's not in English, so they have some trouble with that. But
and that's sad,
you know,
because there are teleprompters in every, but the emotion, the action on stage should communicate it to you. Read the libretto and you understand the story.
I agree.
You know, and it's a shame. And I like all kinds of music. Don't get me wrong. I do. I don't like bass thumping, you know, just for the sake of bass thumping. But I like all music. There are some vocalists who are so good, who are so exquisite. I like Barbara Streisand very, very much. How do you feel about her?
Not crazy. I think she pushes it. The breathing is pretty obvious. Very often she relies on the dynamics of her voice in rather than the emotion. That's not always the case, but more very often for me she's
I think in her early craft probably was a lot better than it is now. Were you a fan of Linda Ronstadt?
I always thought she was you were talking about in rock and roll, I thought she was wonderful. I mean, she could, there again, she's communicating joy. She knew what she was doing. By the time she's doing the Riddle stuff, it always seems to me she's just slightly flat through the whole thing.
A lot of times, don't you think, by the time pop singers get around to doing old standards, it's almost too late. They need to do.
They don't have the
standards.
Chops, and they never had the
yes.
training. You know, we
yes.
were thinking about opera when Frank retired. You know, in the early 70s, he was gone for a couple of years, and he didn't expect to come back. You know, his career he thought was over because his last album had sold like 40,000 copies. And he thought, well, that's the end of that. So, you know, he lived it up for a bit, but, you know, eventually he decided to come back, and he hadn't done the exercises that the tenor back in the late 30s had taught him. And but Frank, being no dimwit, went over to the Met again and spoke to Robert Merrill, and Merrill brought him up to speed.
Yeah, wow. Wow, that's amazing. Very interesting. So, Professor, what's next on your list? I love the fact that we've talked music, we've talked about so many different things. What are you doing next? Are you writing a new book?
I have, yes. The trilogy is many of my readers know. In 2009, I set out on a long journey to immerse myself in 1850s London and write three books, three Victorian mystery thrillers about a person who was alive at the time, a brilliant man named Thomas De Quincey, who anticipated the theories of Freud by 70 years. Back in the 20s, he started with his theories. And so the third one, and maybe the last one, is called Ruler of the Night. And it comes out on November 15, and I'm just finishing the editorial. I had some really, really good editorial suggestions, which are the best kind about, you know, is this dialogue, this little bit here, perfectly clear? Can we make it clearer? Or, you know, is this scene too long? Is this scene too short? You know, sure. Dramatic questions. So I've been addressing those and hope to get the manuscript back the first of the month. And so it comes out November 15. A specialty press called Gauntlet Press is releasing the novelization I wrote for Rambo First Blood Part 2 in a signed collector's edition with a wealth of extras. I went through what I jokingly call my vaults, which are just some boxes for each book. And it's just a ton of stuff. Last year, a similar book for First Blood was published, and then next year, Rambo 3, the novelization for that again with a ton of extras. Really useful background stuff. So I'm doing that, and then I'm putting together a book of nonfiction. It's a little too soon to talk about a release date. It's called Stars in My Eyes. And it's Stars in My Eyes, my love affair with books, music, and movies. And the Sinatra and the Nelson Riddle pieces will be in there, but I don't know when that'll happen. So, you know, if people want to read them now, the e-books are available. And then I have in July a story in a special edition of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. And I have a story in a Sherlock Holmes collection coming out in September called Echoes of Sherlock Holmes, but it's a story about Conan Doyle. So there's a lot of, it's called The Spiritualists, and it's why Conan Doyle was interested in mediums.
Busy year.
Well,
are you going to be at Thriller Fest again this year?
As the co-founder with Gail Lins of ITW.
You have to be there, right?
If I'm not, people would wonder what the heck
happened to you. And
BoucherCon? For BoucherCon, I absolutely must be there because I'm very honored to be receiving BoucherCon's Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yay! I will see you there then.
So I'm very, very excited about that.
That's wonderful.
Well, you know, I remember speaking to my friend, a wonderful author, Donald E. Westlake, who is very encouraging to me.
Yes.
And I remember phoning Don one day and saying, you know, Don, if I went to BoucherCon, do you think anybody would care? And he said, oh, you know, give it a try. This was very early in my career. And so when I got the call telling me that I was going to get the Lifetime Achievement Award, I thought of that, you know, from humble beginnings. You know, it's been a long career, and it's nice to know that
it's
appreciated.
You deserve it. I have a quick question about a book that you wrote in 2013. It was a little book, but it was called The Architecture of Snow.
Yes.
Will you please tell us a little bit about that book? I'm very fascinated by this book.
It's a 12,000 word, if we can call it novelette, I guess, I'm fascinated by J.D. Salinger, and I, you know, how he was that hermit for so many years up in New Hampshire, and I thought I would write a story about an editor who gets a manuscript out of nowhere by a name he can't, you know, doesn't mean anything. But the manuscript sure feels like another writer. And he begins to suspect, I don't use the name J.D. Salinger, it's R.W. Wentworth in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And he begins to suspect that this guy named Wentworth, a very famous novelist who became a hermit, sent this book under a pseudonym. And why would he have done that? And if it is, why has he been a hermit for so long? And so the editor goes on a quest to find out who wrote the manuscripts and winds up in New England and winds up at the, you know, the compound that the hermit writer lives in and has a life-changing experience. It's almost going to Shangri-La when he breaks into the compound and meets this man that he's worshipped for a very long time. And the book is called the long story is called The Architecture of Snow. It's a line from again that professor thing. It's a line from an Emerson poem, and it's about the interconnectedness of everything. And I get a lot of comments about that piece. It's available as an e-book. With an introduction, and it, you know, it
only
means
99 cents too. It's
only 99 cents, but you know, for 12,000 words, it's tough to get. It's an odd size, so the e-books, and it's going to be released actually in a hardback anthology coming up by Borderlands Press, maybe in 6 months from now. So it'd be nice to see it in print.
Well, I have three more comments. The first one is I want to remind everyone about the De Quincey books. The first one is Murder as a Fine Art. It is just mind-bogglingly, beautifully written. The prose is exquisite. You spent years researching this. I remember when this book came out and we started talking about it. The second book is Inspector of the Dead. That's the second De Quincey. The third one will be out at the end of the year. If you've not read these Victorian thrillers, you are missing out on some of the most beautiful literature ever written. Second thing I want to say is, who does your audiobooks for the Victorian mysteries?
Well, that's Mulholland Book is my books are my publisher for those books, and that's part of Little Brown. And, you know, audiobooks can be hit and miss. You know, it's often a question of who's doing the reading and who's available. And, you know, I mean, there are lots of factors. But they have a gentleman with a British accent who has narrated both Murder as a Fine Art and Inspector of the Dead. And I have to say, they're pretty cool. They really, really capture the mood. And, you know, it's been a 7-year odyssey for me. In 2009, I became fascinated all of a sudden with the Victorian era, specifically 1850s London. And literally, I feel like I'm coming up from the ocean in a bathysphere, because literally for most of those years, the only books I read either novels from the period or else histories or biographies or cultural studies of the period. So it's been a really major commitment for me, but I've compared it. Richard Matheson is an author I deeply admire, and he wrote a book called A Bid Time Return, which became a movie called Somewhere in Time. And it's about a man who concentrates so much that he goes back to the turn of the century. And I sort of felt that way. My granddaughter had died in 2009, and I was very, very, as you might expect, you know, just so overwhelmed with grief. And I retreated into the Victorian age as a kind of a way of muting my emotions. And I just escaped. It was glorious, and to find this wonderful man, Thomas De Quincey, and you know such advanced views about the human mind and the layers and sunless abysses that it contains. So it's been quite a ride for me.
It'll be nice to have you come back though after this book.
Well,
and
I don't know what I'm going to do. So
I want to say one more thing about David Morrell. The first time when we met at Thriller Fest, I came in with in my hand the first Morrell book that I had ever written, called Brotherhood of the Rose. Brotherhood of the Rose. I had to scotch tape the cover back together again because that book was so cherished. I think I've read it about 10 times. And I remember John Land saying, Pam, you can go over to the bookstore, to the book room, and you can buy a new copy. I was mortified. And you laughed at when you saw my book and you said something to the effect of, I'm glad you still have this, you know, and thank you. And you're very generous about it. But I was so overwhelmed for meeting you. I remember I was almost in tears, and you were very gracious about me having this torn and tattered book that I carried with me from Florida to meet you and have you sign.
Well, you know what you're speaking to is a larger thing that maybe is, you know, worth as we close off. Partly because my son died and from cancer, and my granddaughter died, and there's a lot of pain in the world. And I just am morbidly aware of the pain that people have, and how people hide it pretty well. And you know, a long, long, long time ago, I resolved that if I couldn't make an effort to make people feel better after they spoke to me, just because of a smile or a kind word, then, you know, what was the point?
Sure.
So you say something that's deeply meaningful to me and gratifying, that, you know, that we can, you know, by being nice to each other, what a thought, maybe make, you know, everybody's life a little bit better.
Well, I have to tell you, it has remained in my treasured collection, Professor Morrell, and where it will stay forever. And when it's my time to go, I've told my brother that no one may have my signed books, that they must go with me in the crematory, because I'm not giving them up for anything. I want something to read wherever I end up. You know?
We do indeed read and write crime fiction, right? That's great.
We absolutely do. We absolutely do. Professor David Morrell, you know you're one of my favorite people. I love having
you
on this show.
Thank you.
I'll look forward to seeing you at hopefully Thriller Fest this year, but for sure at VoucherCon, and maybe someplace in between. Who knows? And please come back whenever you want. Let's talk about everything some more.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this was fun. Huh? I mean, normally, when you're talking about books, sometimes there's a kind of a sell going on, and it wasn't necessary here. We were talking about Frank, and you know, he could be a nasty guy. He's one of those examples of, like, Hemingway and Steve McQueen, of people who were immensely able and terrible in real life, but because of their skills were beyond that. You know, and this is anytime I can talk about Frank Sinatra, I'm happy.
Well, then you must come back again, and let's talk about more musicians and more movies and more books. Will you please?
Okay. Yes.
Thank you so much, Professor David Morrell. You know I love you dearly. Thank you
for being my guest tonight.
All right, folks, and there you have it, Professor David Morrell. Go get a Sinatra book. You're going to love it. Thank you. Have a good night. We'll talk again soon. Bye, David.
Hey, that was fun.
Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Good night.